You're listening to the What Do You Actually Do podcast. Each week, we want to bring you an inspiring interview, a useful tip, or encouraging message to help you find your place in the professional world. Hello and welcome to this episode of What Do You Actually Do? My name's Kate Morris and I'll be your host today. In today's episode, we'll be talking about the publishing sector. Today, we're joined by Lewis Lansford, who works as a freelance writer. So Lewis, what do you actually do?
What do I actually do? That is a big question. The main part of my work, as you might guess from the job title, is writing. But nothing is ever that simple. And a question always with writers is, what are you writing? Or why are you writing? Or whose ideas are you writing? I've just come from a workshop with students here at University of York to talk about careers in publishing. And one thing we often speak about is the sort of misapprehension that being a writer consists of coming up with ideas, writing something, and then taking it to a publisher to get it published. Mm. That's rarely the case with me.
So what are the key elements of the role then? How does it work in reality?
In reality, I should actually start by saying that my writing is focused on English language teaching materials. Okay. So I write, for the most part, I write textbooks that people will use who are studying English as a second language, generally outside of the US or the UK, but not exclusively. So English is a foreign language, we could say.
Yeah.
And that sector is known, at least within the sector, as ELT, English language teaching. There was a time in the 70s and 80s when the industry was coming of age that teachers with great ideas came up with course books or ideas for course books, and they would go to a publisher and say, I've got this great idea, let's make a course book. So that's the model that people kind of still have in mind. The way it works now, it's far more corporate, it's far more organized, and far more professional. What tends to happen is publishers identify a gap in the market. They identify a certain market sector. For example, students who are studying engineering or other technical subjects at university level. So people who are studying engineering or other technical subjects at university level, more often than not these days, also need an English language element in their studies. Because chances are they're getting some or all of their lectures in English. And most certainly when they go into the workforce, they will work in English. Not necessarily in the US or the UK with British or American engineers or Canada or Australia or New Zealand or even India or South Africa or other places where English is a first language, but they'll be speaking English. Saudi engineers might be speaking English with Spanish engineers who are working on an oil project in Saudi Arabia. So that's why they need to learn English. So anyway, that market need is identified. And then the publisher looks for someone like me who has experience writing English language teaching materials in technical subject areas. So I get a brief of some kind, often to write a sample unit, and then a decision is made whether to go ahead with a project or not.
So that's interesting. They come to you. You don't go to them pitching an idea. They come to you with we've got this project available. We think this would be a good fit for you. Do you fancy it?
That's correct. And we might get into this, but partly because of the way I came into writing, I can fairly say I've almost never pitched an idea. And I can say with great confidence that I've never pitched an idea that got published. There have been one or two ideas that I came up with that I thought, oh, that would be a good idea. And I put some sample materials together and gave it to people who I know, and it didn't end up, a polite way of putting it would be that it just didn't end up getting published. You know, for whatever reason, it wasn't good enough, or it didn't fit the market well enough, or there were just other things going on that it didn't happen. So I've never put a lot of effort into that approach.
That's interesting, though, because I'm keen to know how they know you exist then. So how did you kind of, what was your starting point? What's your kind of background? How did you sort of break into actually becoming a writer then? If you haven't gone out and said, hey, I'm a writer, people have come to you.
Right. And this is what I was alluding to when I said the route through which or by which I became a writer meant that I was never in this position of pitching. I've worked in publishing for most of my career. When I grew up in the US and I studied English literature at undergraduate level. And at that time decided I wanted to work in publishing. I did some internships and work experience. I worked in fiction publishing. My interest was kind of literary at that time, actually. But then as I embarked on working life, I ended up doing proofreading for an art gallery guide. I ended up proofreading at University of Arizona Press, which is academic publishing, mm-hmm. not literary, and kind of piecing it all together. But those were lean times. I was in Tucson, Arizona. There's not a lot of publishing going on there. And really what I wanted to do was to see the world.
Okay.
So I went off to Spain at the invitation of a friend. He said, oh, come teach English in Spain. No problem. This was the late 80s. It was not a very professional. It wasn't exclusively a professional field at that time. There were a lot of people like me who were just native English speakers who could get some kind of work. So I went along and did that. And what I discovered was that it was a good way to see the world, that I more or less liked teaching English, but I didn't feel I knew what I was doing.
Okay.
So I went back to Arizona and got a master's degree in teaching English for speakers of other languages. Taught for a couple of years at a language center at the University of Arizona. Then I got a job in Japan at teaching at a manufacturing company. So this was the beginning of the seeing the world part of teaching English. And after 2 years teaching at this factory in Japan, which was very stimulating in many ways, but grueling in others, it was a in some ways we could say a tough schedule. I realized that the in and out, the day in and day out song and dance of being a teacher wasn't maybe my cup of tea. And at that point, an opportunity came along to get back into publishing, to work as an editor. So I was recruited by it was then Addison Wesley Longman in Hong Kong to edit materials, to help develop materials for Japan and other markets in East Asia. So that's how I made the jump back into publishing. It's kind of a long story. I'm sorry.
No,
I hope
that's
you stay
good.
With me.
No. I'm still here.
So in the time between taking that job in 1995 and now, more or less what happened is I moved up through the ranks of editorial jobs. I came in as an editor. Then I became a senior editor. Then I moved to the UK and became a freelance project manager. So I was managing editors and taking more of a role in developing materials. But in that job, it's a useful skill to be able to write things in addition to edit them. Often, say, a second edition of a book is being created. The original authors aren't available to write the review units, or they don't want to write the review units, so they need somebody who can do it. And if you're a project manager who's aware that that needs to be done and you can do it yourself, the simplest way is just to say, I will take care of this. So I started picking up little jobs like that along the way. Then it became, writing an entire workbook to go along with a student's course book. And it built up like that. So I was writing, I was picking available writing jobs that just came across my desk as an editorial project manager.
So that's interesting how your different ideas have all kind of bled into each other in a way. So you've kind of got that interest in literature, that's given you sort of a bit of the writing, publishing stuff, but then you wanted to see the world. That's fed into your teaching, but then your teaching fed back into then publishing, which then fed back into your writing. So it's kind of these different experiences have all influenced and impacted on each other. And I'm presuming the contacts that you've built up along the way in them has then allowed you to be in this position where people come to you rather than you go to them.
That's exactly right. I honestly can't remember the last time I actively touted for work or tried to get someone to give me work. And the reason is that I came from Hong Kong. I was with Addison Wesley, they then became Pearson Education while I was there. Came into work with Pearson Education as a freelance project manager in the UK. And it was in the late 90s. I sent CVs to Cambridge University Press, Oxford University Press, Macmillan, the big ELT publishers. Mm. And exactly one of those CVs that I sent out led to something.
Okay.
But it took about 3 years. Mm. I got a call after 3 years, someone phoned up and said, hi, Lewis, I've seen your CV. I'm from Oxford University Press. And I thought, yeah, I guess I did send something several years ago. But in fact, that contact has led to I've been working with them ever since.
So is your approach pretty typical or, say, other authors who have got into the industry differently and who kind of operate within the industry differently?
In fact, I won't say I'm unique, but not far from it. Okay. I don't know. I cannot think of another author. I started off, my first job in publishing was proofreading, which is literally the, you know, you could go to the mailroom in a publisher, but in terms of working with text, the most basic job you can have in publishing is proofreading. And I've worked up and done just about every job that you can do in working with text right up to creating it. Probably more people who do what I do are teachers who started developing their own materials and sought publishers. Even 10 years ago, that was more the done thing. A lot of people who do what I do are active teachers. So they teach and also write. On the one hand, that's seen as hugely superior to my position because they have day-to-day contact with students. But on the other hand, I've had to defend this, you know, how can you possibly write materials full time? How can, you know, you don't have access to students or classrooms. But in fact, publishers send me to observe classes and I go to conferences and talk with teachers. And I myself do a lot of teacher training. So I get contact with teachers in that way. And I also am able to sort of, I view myself as a professional writer and I fully devote myself to professional development. I take courses. I'm active in professional bodies and it's what I do 9 to 5 and beyond, you know? So I think there are benefits with that, that I'm, there are no distractions, we could say.
But it sounds like for a lot of people, it would be, if you're going to write up in nonfiction, you've got to be an expert in the subject area that you're writing about. So to whether it's teaching or making music or, you know, whatever it is, to be practicing in that field, as well as having the actual writing skills. And then you would take that to a publisher and you'd have the credentials to back it up. That would be a more regular way to break into that role.
I think that's right. But what I've developed is an understanding of text and materials from down to the full stops, you know, from the very bottom. I know what the business of putting a book together is. And so I've made a kind of expertise, if you see what I mean, of that. Yeah. Because if you work with an author who doesn't really know to look at a book, we talk about the spread, a left-hand page and a right-hand page, that works as a single unit. And anyone in publishing would talk about a spread and knows that you don't have an exercise on a right-hand page that you have to flip over and refer to something on the back of it because that's incredibly awkward in class. Yeah. But if you're a teacher who's putting together ideas for a textbook, you've got a lot to learn in terms of the mechanics of a book. And so that's, you know, what I lack in maybe regular contact with students, I make up for in the ability to rock and roll when it comes to thinking of it, not just of the ideas of what we're going to do in the lesson, but mechanically how it fits together in a book.
So that's interesting then. Is that something that you think would be useful for people who wanted to be a professional writer to get maybe a bit of work experience within a publishing firm to understand the process and the sort of the more commercial aspects of it so they can think of what they're doing, they can anticipate what a publisher might need from them, they can make it a more attractive sell in the beginning?
The principle of what you're describing is absolutely correct. It would save a lot of heartbreak because what you find is teachers are quite rightly and quite understandably very loyal to their idea for the book that they put together. But for some reason, from a sales and marketing perspective, it may not work. There may be material in there that doesn't click in to a certain market that the book has to sell into in order to be financially viable. And so if teachers who are writing were made aware of the needs, not only of the students who they're picturing in their heads or who they're working with every day, but also the fact that they're part of a large organization that itself has very valid needs. If you want to get paid for writing your book, someone has to sell that book.
Yeah.
If someone's going to sell that book, you can't put things in there that make it not saleable in a market that needs to support the project. So if all writers were given a 3-week course that included training on book budgets, book schedules, why can't I have a full color photograph on every page? Because each one costs 100 quid or whatever. there are all kinds of just bread and butter sort of decisions that are made inside publishing houses that affect the content of books that, because of an experience, teachers who are writing just don't know about. All they ever see is finished books and think, oh, I want mine to look like that. But it looks like that because of all these people doing their job to make it happen.
So it sounds like having that real commercial understanding is important. What other kind of skills or personal qualities would you say someone needs to have if they're going to have a successful career as a writer?
To be the kind of writer who I am, who's a jobbing writer, people come to me. I'm a, you could say, a technical writer, although there is an art to what I do. The fact that I was interested in creative writing once upon a time, well, yeah, this is creative writing that I'm doing. And here's an example that, in fact, refers to the conversation we were just having. Often, publishers will come to a writer and say, we need you to write to a certain word count, or we need you not to refer to certain animals or certain food products because of the market this will sell into. And I know personally many writers who feel offended by that. They feel that it's limiting their work, that it's stifling their creativity. My take on that is that any kind of limitation actually is a spur to my creativity.
Okay.
If you tell me there are five things I can't put in a text, then I have to dig deeper. I have to get away from the things, my normal habits of putting things in a text. And I still want it to be related to the real world. I want students to love it. I want teachers to like it. I don't want teachers to say, oh, yeah, you know, now we'll turn to the boring text on page 98. So it's got to be great. And it has to have these limitations.
Yeah.
It has to observe these limitations. To me, that is greater creativity than just being given free rein to write whatever pops into your head. So what I'm getting at in terms of skill is, creativity, whatever that is, but also an ability to not see compromise as a bad thing.
To really be sort of flexible.
To be flexible and, you know, loyal to the quality of your work and, you know, fierce in defense of the integrity of what you're trying to do, but open-minded about exactly how that may play out. You need to communicate openly with people. You need to know when to draw lines and say, look, no, I'm sorry. I refuse to, I don't know, some people might say in certain markets you can't, in English language teaching, write about evolution. And some people might draw the line and say, look, if you're going to tell me I can't write about evolution, then I don't want to work on this project. So a skill would just be to say, all right, this is my line. I'm going to communicate with you openly. We're not having a fight about it. It's not emotional. It's just a rational conversation between two professionals. So that kind of ability to communicate is hugely helpful. An ability to, I spend a lot of my time, all right, back up a little bit. The way a typical book project goes is I write a draft of material. I'm given a brief and I write what I think is something really good that fills that brief. That gets sent off to an editor. And occasionally I get a note back that says, this is brilliant. We don't need to change anything. But more often than not, I get comments back that identify ways it could be improved. And depending on the voice of the editor, the language the editor uses, and their personality, sometimes it's easy to take and other times it's not. But the tone of voice that someone uses in their comments, if you see what I mean, even though it's written feedback, that has a tone of voice. I have to have the skill of ignoring the tone of voice and then identifying what's actually a good comment and what's not a good comment. Because just because they're an editor doesn't mean everything they say is right. So I have to work through, you know, sort of my own sense of feeling, not attacked, but, you know, I put myself into it. And everything
it's a criticism, isn't it?
Right. It is a criticism. And I know I've been at this long enough to know that that criticism will make the material better. But still, there are times when it's just, you know, oh, no, that really hurt, you know. And so you have to learn to deal with criticism and see it as the editor is your friend. Ultimately, you're trying to do the same thing, publish the best possible work.
So having that kind of personal resilience, that ability to see the bigger picture, it sounds like that's pretty important then for this process.
It is. Then it's a delicate balance between being loyal to your ideas and putting a lot of yourself into them, which shows, you know, even if it's English for engineering, and I'm not exaggerating, something that seems quite dry and technical, can be written in a dry and technical, I don't care kind of way, or it can be written in a with care and pride and some humanity in it. And so you've got to retain that, but then not just feel like you want to cry when somebody says, well, actually, it's got a bit too much humanity in it, or, you know, it needs to be a bit more technical.
Remove that humanity.
It's like, okay, you know, as long as you're telling me that based on good sound market feedback or something, then we'll change it.
So what sort of words of advice would you give for anyone out there who is thinking, I'd like to build a career as an author? Like, how should they start out?
There are so many possible ways to answer that question. I think in a way, I might come back to that, but I'd like to answer a different question. Because what I launched into life with was some general principles or general proclivities. I'm not sure. I wanted to travel and see the world.
Yes.
I thought I wanted to work in publishing. I wanted to work in publishing. I wanted to work with text and words and ideas. And I guess on some level, I do come from a family of teachers, and there was some sense that teaching was possibly a good place to be. And so with those three things kind of on my horizon, I looked for what was available where I was and looked for opportunities. So when this old friend phoned up and said, come teach in Spain, I said, well, that ticks two of the boxes, teaching and travel. I'll go do that. And then I did it until it wasn't really working anymore. I could see that there was only so much I could do with what I had. So I thought, okay, well, you know, what happens next? So back to Arizona. And then in fact, it was just a chance conversation with a friend there who said, oh, yeah, I'm looking at this master's degree at the University of Arizona. You know, what do you think? And I hadn't really thought about it. And I think by the end of that week, I'd enrolled on that course because it just fell into place. Yeah. I didn't have any specific ambitions. My ambitions were general. So what I'm saying is one thing led to another. I kept in mind some general things that were comfortable and things that were not comfortable, or things I wanted to do and things I wanted to avoid, and looked for whatever opportunity was available that was acceptable, rather than saying, I want to be a writer, I'm going to go and do that. Because I don't think anyone could look at what I'm doing now. I couldn't tell you what to do except to do what I did. And what I did was never, it makes so much sense looking back over the last 25 years. It's this really neat one thing led to another trajectory. Yeah. It's a trajectory without a doubt. But as I was sailing along that trajectory, it was random. It was chaos. It was decisions based on convenience or availability or, you know, a lot of random influences and a lot of very good luck. But I landed on my feet, I guess you could say. I love my work. I'm very happy where I am.
That's probably quite reflective of the sector, though, that it's not a kind of a linear pathway where there's a nice grad scheme. Oh, here's how you become a writer. It's building up different experiences, and it sounds like taking every opportunity you can that is interesting, as is in the general ballpark of things that you want to be doing. Keeping connections, maintaining them, developing more connections, taking opportunities to do extra things, like you said when you were doing the publishing, because you'd done a bit of writing, you knew you could do those edits and those extra sections for the second editions, which then led to doing your own writing. So it's kind of taking opportunities, getting on with it, not holding back, waiting for it to happen, but also having thought about what it is you want to be gaining, rather than just, you weren't just drifting along in the wind, you had some key areas that you knew you were interested in. Okay, well,
can I just come back to just one more? There is a more straightforward answer to your original question as well. Like, what advice would I give?
Yeah.
But this is quite specific to my sector. But there is, if anyone gets into teaching, one way teachers get into publishing that's not just blindly sending a manuscript. I, in my work on certain projects, rely on teachers reading and commenting and sometimes practice teaching something I've written in their classroom. It's called piloting. So I'll write a sample unit. It gets sent out to teachers. They pilot it. They say, this worked, that didn't work. My students loved this, they hated that. Teachers who do that are often paid some kind of honorarium, £100 or something like that. But what they're doing is building a relationship with a publisher. And they're showing their ability to understand and interact with and comment on text. And so for somebody who wanted to get into writing, the first way to do it would be to contact your local publisher as a teacher and say, I'm a teacher,
yeah,
and I would love to pilot some materials. And almost certainly you would get something to pilot. And then if you said, I'm a teacher and I'm piloting materials and I'd like to write something, do you have any review units that need writing or anything like that? And so it would build up slowly with bits and pieces that most people don't even think about, yeah, or know about. Yeah. That's the problem. People know they want to be a writer, but all they see is the name on the front of a, yeah, course book. Yeah. They don't see the guy who did the index or the word list at the back or the grammar reference, for example. That might be written by another nameless person. So there are all these little bits and pieces that you could get involved with if only you know to make yourself available.
So it's really making those speculative applications and being proactive about it, again, rather than waiting to see an advert necessarily for those.
Completely.
Kind of jobs.
And it would also be, and you probably talk about this a lot, but networking.
Yeah.
And a network can take a very long time to build up. But I would say follow, if you're on LinkedIn, for example, join groups related to publishing, join the chatter and the chat and the banter around publishing. If you're in a, if you were a teacher somewhere, I think I was, you know, I was working in publishing in Hong Kong or in Japan. I know that the teachers, there was some overlap socially between teachers and publishing people.
Okay.
And so if you get chatting to somebody who works in publishing, you might find that they need this or that. So it would be, you know, it's not even professional networking. It's almost trying to become friends with,
yeah,
people who work in publishing. But there are, you know, there are ways you can do that. You can't do it just like that. But if you just in any way possible get closer to the sector,
yes,
on any terms that you want to work in, that's the way you create opportunity.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to add some relevant links to the episode description and a full link to the transcript of today's show. So thank you so much for talking to us today, Lewis. That's been really interesting. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the humanity in the engineering books. Thanks for joining us this week on What Do You Actually Do? This episode was hosted by myself, Kate Morris, and edited and produced by the Careers and Placements team. If you love this podcast, spread the word and subscribe. Are you eager to get more tips? Follow University of York Careers and Placements on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. All useful links are in this episode description. This has been produced at the University of York Careers and Placements. For more information, visit york.ac.uk/careers.